You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you after a long weekend in professional cycling when Jonas Vingegaard and his Visma Lisa Bike teammates premiered a TT helmet design apparently modelled on promo posters for the Jaws movie franchise. And the clear message from Tadej Pogacar at Strade Bianche was that everyone racing him this year is going to need a bigger boat. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will be country hopping from Italy to France and back again, race hopping from Strade Bianche to Paris-Nice, maybe with a stop at Tirreno Adriatico as well, and tense hopping from the past to the future and perhaps even the present. It is going to be an unusual episode because it's being recorded in several chunks, tranches at different moments, and to help me hopefully negotiate the labyrinthine timings that I'm trying to negotiate today, it is young Richard Abraham who's with me in person on Paris-Nice. And well, Richard, what a palatial setting, what an opulent
the Marshall's Hotel in Auxerre.
Yeah, and it probably was quite palatial and opulent
once upon a time.
It's somewhat faded now. You commented earlier that we seem to be, or well, we're being overlooked by a sort of cherubic portrait of a young boy who perhaps once looked like Tadej Pogacar, or Tadej Pogacar once looked
like him.
Yeah, what a setting it is. A very Paris-Nice, very becoming of Paris-Nice, the start of Paris-Nice, the first 3 days. Traditionally now we spend them in the Parisian suburbs, the Yvelines area of Paris, and it's generally pretty cold. It's generally pretty dreary. Today was not dreary. Today was bright and sunny, and we had a lovely start to the day outside a zoo.
I didn't see any animals. I saw some kind of like sculptured animals. Well, sculptures is maybe a strong word for... They were animal shapes, 3D animal shapes outside a zoo.
nothing quite as noteworthy as the parakeets, the sort of papier-mâché parrots on the tables are in the curry house that
we ate last night.
Nothing that remarkable. But as I say, we are at Paris-Nice. We're going to be talking about that race. We're going to be talking about Strade Bianche, which of course took place on Saturday. We're going to be hearing from riders. We might hear from another regular contributor, regular guest indeed on the Cycling Podcast, who's also at Paris-Nice later on in the episode. But Richard, tradition dictates that at this point in the podcast, at the start of the podcast, we have a bit of a news roundup. Tradition also dictates that I usually do it, or I have done in the last few months. Today's going to be a bit different because I've had the towel on my sun lounger for several hours now.
I've seen you just lounging around at starts and finishes, taking it easy.
Yes, and I'm going to recline and enjoy you do the bulk of the news roundup today. So off you go.
Well, should we start in Tuscany with what is now the second biggest news story coming from Tuscany of the cycling world after Jumbo Visma Lisa Bikes helmets? I mean, today Pogacar, of course, the big talking point, returning for the peloton for the first time in 5 months, and well, deciding to leave it within the space of a few hours and disappearing off. Well, he attacked on the same section of Sterato, the Monte Santa Maria, where he attacked in 2022 to win the race. The difference this year, of course, was that there was another 30 kilometres on what I think organisers would like to call the sixth monument. Let's not get into that.
We will get into it to a certain extent later on in the episode.
What had initially been an act of apparent tactical insanity turned to, well, a moment of tactical genius, because his lead just stretched out and out and out to 4 minutes at one point, I think. Merckxian, Coppian, Hinoian, whatever, choose your adjective, of riders past. I mean, the win was arguably as much down to the chase, or the lack of it, as it was Pogacar's virtuosity, because the group behind was fractured, disjointed, perhaps not of the calibre of opposition that and maybe the organisers would have hoped for, but and also due to the wind and rain, which turned that sort of white road into a kind of gloopy beige mud. There were attempts to chase him down. Benoit Cosnefroy, Ben Healy, Maxime Van Gils, Tom Scoinch and Tom Pidcock all sort of had a dig from that chase group at various points. And it was those last three, Scoinch, Van Gils and Pidcock, who placed second, third and fourth in the end in Siena. But it was very much a case of Pogacar first and the rest nowhere. What made it even more remarkable is that Pogacar essentially told everybody what he was going to do. He said he was going to attack where he did, and duly did it. It was sort of echoes of Frank Vandenberg in 1999, Liège, I believe.
Echoes of that race in that they both had bleached blonde hair.
So they did, yeah. We'll talk about Pog's greatest hits, the latest one for the collection later on,
The quintessential Pog-cineration. Well, there have been many of those already.
That would be, you'd probably put that like third or fourth on the greatest hits album, I think, already. Like after, some of the newer stuff would come at the end, but that's a real banker, I think.
I feel we're about three references away from a Taylor Swift conversation here. please, let's get on to the women's
race.
Steer
that to, Lotte Kopecky. She very much atoned for a second place at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad on the opening weekend with what was pretty comprehensive a win at the women's race in Strada Bianchi. She came into the bottom of the final climb, the Via Santa Caterina, with the Italian champion, Elisa Longoborghini, but it was pretty much game over as soon as Kopecky attacked from Longoborghini's wheel. She soloed up those flagstones to the Piazza del Campo. It's her second win in 3 years, and the woman who beat her last year, Demi Vollering, was third behind Longoborghini, who actually, the Italian rider, didn't have to wait that long to take what was her first victory of the season, 24 hours later, in fact, at the tongue-twistingly difficult Trofeo Oro in Euro. How was that, Daniel? Is that right?
I better check what it's actually called. I think it's called
Oro in Euro or Euro in Euro.
It sounds like a fundamentally difficult one to pronounce. Yeah. Trofeo Oro in Euro. Yeah. There we go. It's one of those. The Italians are very fond of tongue twisters, and that could be one indeed. Started in Cinquale, finished in Cinquale, also a bit of a tongue twister.
Cinquale. That was up on near Livorno, isn't it? Up on the coast towards La Spezia there. So not too far from Siena. At the same time on Saturday in the men's peloton was the Grand Prix Criquillon, which was won by Alex Seger of Lotto Destiny. The first of two wins for Lotto, in fact. The second came a day later at the Grand Prix Montserrat, which was won by Jana van der Paar in conditions that were probably best described as Belgian. So let's stick in Belgium. A couple of races in that sort of southwestern corner of Flanders. It doesn't always get the headlines. But it was the GP La Semaine, and, well, Intermarché Wanty's Lawrence Rex had a slightly nervous wait for confirmation that his half-aborted salute hadn't cost him the victory to a very fast-finishing Antonio Morgado of UAE Team Emirates. And, well, earlier in the day, Vittoria Guazzini of FDJ Suez had won the women's race. Let's nip back to Italy again and the Trofeo Laiguella on the Riviera, where, well, Lenny Martinez kept up a run that is as remarkable as it is relevant, I think, namely that the cycling world has never been much more than a fortnight away from a victory by a rider called Lenny. Lennart van Eytvelt obviously this season.
Oh, okay.
This season.
So it's like,
Of all time.
You need to nuance that slightly. I was wondering which era defining rider called Lenny.
Lenny Merckx. We'll probably talk more about this Lenny Martinez in future weeks. He's actually had quite a good start to the season, hasn't he? Var Classique, and he was second behind Vingegaard in Au Gran Camino as well.
Yeah, he was also linked in this morning's press in Le Monde of all places, the last newspaper on earth that should be really indulging in transfer speculation. He was linked with a move to Bahrain Victorious. He's out of contract at the end of the year. Persons connected to Bahrain Victorious were slightly mystified by this when it was put to them this morning at the start of Paris-Nice.
I would imagine that Groupama would probably want to do all they can to keep hold of him.
Definitely, definitely. And one would think as well, with the riders that they lost at the end of last year, namely Thibaut Pinot and Arnaud Démare, there is maybe a bit of surplus in their budget as well, a bit of pocket money that they will be able to spend on keeping Lenny Martinez.
You'll be interested to note, Daniel, following our conversation in the Indian Palace last night, that two wins, a right-handed victory salute and a left-handed victory salute.
Really?
Yeah. So make of that what you will.
Yeah, I noted last night that it is very rare to see a one-handed salute at the end of a bike race celebration, a left-handed salute. Thibaut Pinot is one of the few riders in recent years that we've seen win regularly with a left-handed salute.
Well, he's heard that. And because maybe this most recent one was the left-handed salute in Trofeo Lagalia. Second was Andrea Vendrame of the Decathlon 82R, and Juan Ayuso of UAE Team Emirates came third. And well, I was watching Leonard Kemner, obviously, at the Tirreno opening TT. I'm not sure that many people were. He came 14th, but that was won by Ayuso quite impressively, actually, on a Panflat 10k TT.
The latest of several very good results for UAE riders in time trials this year.
Absolutely. Not just wins, but kind of, you know, everyone was pretty impressed by Isaac Del Toro in the Volta Algarve, wasn't he? Beating no less than Filippo Ganna and Jonathan Milan, two mainstays of the Italian Team Pursuit squad there, and certainly no slouches on the TT bike. So very impressive result for Juan Ayuso. He's one of a pretty stacked field of GC riders actually at this stage race, which finishes on Sunday. Vingegaard is there, there's Ben O'Connor, Jai Hindley, Mark Hirschi, probably riding in support for Ayuso, I'd imagine, but also Romain Baudet, who's looked quite good this year so far in the early French races, Ben Healy, and then probably the fastest sprinter in the world in Tim Melier at this moment, along with Jasper Philipsen, Caleb Ewan there in Italy this week. Probably the most decisive stage for the GC comes on Saturday with an uphill finish to the Monte Petrano. You been there, Daniel?
No, I've never been there, but it's well known to, well, anyone who watched cycling at the sort of end of the noughties, because in 2009 the Giro d'Italia had a famous, a memorable stage that finished at the top of Monte Petrano, and that was the sort of upside down Giro that kind of shunned the Alps and Dolomites, or pretty much shunned them, and finished way down sort of in central Italy, and the Queen stage really finished at Monte Petrano. So that will be a challenge for the riders, and it should be a good spectacle as well. Beautiful part of the world.
And it concludes on Sunday with what should be a sprint finish, I think. So moving on into other news, the UCI announced that it's looking into hookless rims, quote, as a matter of urgency, after what it noted were a series of recent incidents involving the use of hookless rims on tubeless tyres.
Can you illuminate us?
Well, I had to kind of find out do my own research on hookless rims, actually, I'll confess. Well, it came to the fore because Thomas de Gendt, who rides for Lotto Destiny, had a rather sort of innocuous or bizarre-looking crash, sort of almost out of nothing, at the UAE Tour a week or so ago. He was ended up on the floor. His bike ended up leant against the central reservation with a very obvious unseated tyre, a foam insert popping out, and tyre sealant spewing everywhere. There were suggestions afterwards that it was perhaps incompatible components on a hookless rim system that might have played a part in Degent's crash, although it should be said that Lotto were pretty quick to sort of dismiss that, saying that what they were doing was 100% within the technical rules. So basically hookless rims are pretty much what they say on the tin. They obviously are able to make the rim slightly lighter by removing the hooks and some of the engineering that goes into that, and removing material from the rim and relying more on the tension of a well-fitted tire to keep it sat on the rim, essentially. The obvious corollary of that is that you have to be a little bit more careful with the tolerances and what tires you put on what rims, specifically what width tire you put on what width rim, and that seems to be perhaps the issue, if not with De Gendt, then definitely in general with hookless rims technology. the CPA, well, the president of the riders union, the CPA, Adam Hansen, has said that they're not happy with riders racing on hookless rim systems. So I think it's something to keep an eye on. I'm not actually sure how many teams are using that at the moment.
You're talking to the wrong guy.
Yeah. Well, if you've got a little bit of time,
it is the kind of thing that I feel tomorrow, like I should know a lot more about. I generally have about one conversation a year with someone about tyres, and it's probably not sufficient.
Tomorrow,
my annual conversation about tubeless tyres took place in about March last year, and I've not spoken to anyone about tyres since then. But that's, I shall endeavour to do so this week.
Something I noticed actually here at Paris-Nice was the UCI jury strolling around with a kind of homemade jig to measure handlebar hood angle, going around and checking initially by eye and then anything that looks slightly suspicious, like it might be tilted in.
Pogacar's were less inclined the weekend in Strade Bianche than they looked at the end of last year.
Okay.
I'd certainly say.
From what I could gather, the UCI's and the commissaires especially are normally very coy when it comes to talking about this sort of thing. Especially at races. I remember trying to figure out what was going on when they came up with the motor detection technology and the iPads, and obviously they sort of don't want to give away the technology that they're using, but this is very obvious. It's a little plastic rig. They seem to be going off the angle of the drops, so a lot of riders that had flared drops were able to kind of get away with a slightly inward tilting handlebar, and it seems like more and more riders are probably going to lean towards that in order to make the most of that.
Maybe this week I'll also have my annual handlebar
chat.
It'll be interesting to see actually tomorrow when Juan Ayuso has already ridden, he's already raced this year, so those paying close attention will already know whether he has made adjustments, because he was one of the worst or best offenders last year. He was one of the riders with the most severely inclined handlebars. We've seen a lot of severely inclined handlebar moustaches around already, especially on UAE team, in fact. Brandon McNulty, Jay Vine as well, sporting one.
Gaviria had one as well, didn't he, I think?
Yeah, Jose Serpa, remember him, lookalike. Antonio Morgado as well is sporting a remarkable moustache.
There's a few mullets creeping back as well, dare I say.
Well, there was one at Paris-Nice today, leading Paris-Nice, in fact. I fear we're straying.
That's a good place to wrap things up.
Well, what an excellent debut that was, doing the world round. You might have just worked your way into pole position, into the sort of box seat for doing the news roundup in future weeks. Richard, I just wanted to mention one thing. While you were recapping and filling us in there on what's been going on in races all around Europe, I was just browsing some results as well. One race that didn't make the news roundup, but it is a 1.1 race. I'm slightly dubious about that, because a 1.1 race is quite an important race. However, it doesn't sound like an important race. Gran Premi Les Franqueses in Catalunya took place on the 3rd. So that was yesterday, on Sunday. The reason this caught my eye was the rider who finished 3rd was a rider called Marcos Freire. Who do you think Marcos Freire might be related to?
$1 question.
Yes. I did know that Oscar Freire, three-time World Road Race Champion, had a son called Marcos. I also knew that one or more of Oscar Freire's children raced and raced quite well. But I was just looking at Marcos Freire's results in addition to that 3rd place yesterday. He has had some significant results in some big Spanish junior races over the last few months, so that is definitely a name to look out for over the coming years.
That generation of Spanish riders have got sons now, starting to find their feet. Although I did spot there was a Zubeldia riding for, I think, Euskaltel team, who actually is no relation to Aymar, unfortunately, but Joseba Beloki's son, whose first name escapes me,
Markel,
is on
EF. All very depressing, because this is now two complete generations I'm sort of getting to the point where I'm seeing the sons of riders whose whole career I witnessed, which is absolutely soul destroying. Anyway,
well, did we work out how old Arvid Deklein is in the end, the self-professed kind of older
late
man,
bloomer.
Late bloomer, that was it. Yeah,
he's probably about 18. No, Arvid Deklein is, in fact, I can tell you, he is a late bloomer, in fact. He really is. He's 29.
Oh, okay. He looked younger than 29.
Yeah, so that makes me feel a whole lot better. I'm going to skip off into the distance now. We both are in readiness for part two.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by LinkedIn Sales Navigator. I'm sure everyone out there is very familiar with LinkedIn already. Perhaps you're on the platform yourself and you know that it's the place to network with other professionals, establish contacts, showcase your own skills, and even share your business challenges with others and perhaps pick up some tips along the way too. And of course, thanks to LinkedIn Jobs, which you may have heard about on the podcast before, it's also a powerful recruiting tool, linking you up to a global network of potential recruits for your company. But did you also know that LinkedIn could help your company's sales team identify the best clients, establish contacts, and close deals? Cold contacts are time-consuming when it comes to selling, and they can be annoying for the potential customer, especially when sellers are using shallow and outdated data, which sometimes means they're contacting the wrong person and sometimes the wrong organisations altogether. Well, LinkedIn Sales Navigator can cut through all of that and can help to give your sales team high-quality data and accurate real-time insights into potential customers, helping to approach the people who are more likely to be interested in becoming customers of your company. This information helps sales teams target their efforts more effectively, and LinkedIn calls it deep sales, meaning it can reduce the amount of time wasted and lead to more sales being converted and bigger deals. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is the first deep sales platform, and you can try it now with a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/win. That's linkedin.com/win, and you can get a 60-day free trial, so try it risk-free and let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/win and get started today.
Yeah, I watched it. It was pretty crazy.
What did you make of that one?
When he came out from Monte Santa Maria, you could see nobody could catch him back again. Like the way he was pedaling was actually pretty impressive, but also behind there were not organization. Like a lot of team got a lot of riders, but they never really sacrificed. It looks like they just gave up to say, okay, we race for second, that's it.
I think most people watching were sort of open jawed. You know, nobody expected that kind of attack, but I mean, you've raced with Tadej, you've been on the same team as him. Did you know he had that in his locker?
No, I didn't. I wouldn't expect it, to be honest. I would expect him to go maybe, you know, first time over not Le Tolfe, the one before, I don't remember the name anymore. But I mean, it's Tadej. You never know what he has in his mind. So and he delivered, so nobody can say anything about that.
Have you spotted him doing these 80-kilometer hard efforts around Monaco? Has he been training specifically for that?
No, we didn't train together once this year because I was in training camp, he wasn't, and we never matched the training.
It's quite unusual. I mean, he hasn't gone to altitude like some of his other rivals.
Normally, I think also last year he didn't go to altitude before. I mean, depends from the. He has a super busy program. It would be super hard to match Giro and Tour, which I already know in his mind is winning the both. It's from 98, nobody does it, so probably it's something he's targeting. Didn't tell, but I'm pretty sure he's targeting to do that. And yeah, I think they made the right choice.
Well, Richard, that was, it was you, and it was Matteo Trentin, Italian rider, who wasn't at Strade Bianche. So what were you doing interviewing him? Well, I hope it was pretty obvious in that clip. You were talking to Matteo Trentin because he's a former teammate of Tadej Pogacar. He's a near neighbour, I guess, in Monaco, knows him very well. And he certainly watched, what we witnessed yesterday and what everyone at Paris-Nice pretty much saw. We got the impression and was, to a greater or lesser extent, shaken by, rocked by, certainly impressed by. It was certainly a talking point at the start this morning, wasn't it?
I think probably most of the Paris-Nice peloton was glued to their TV in their whatever boxy hotel they were in.
Let's talk about the boxy hotel. This is going to be, we've already established it's going to be a strange episode. I don't know where we currently are on the space-time continuum, but temporarily it is Sunday night and we're sitting in the breakfast bar of the hotel we're staying in on, or I'm staying in on Sunday night. It's not breakfast time. It's we were actually going to have a curry.
Indian Palace.
The Indian Palace.
Which looks in far Plaisir. From palatial.
Yeah, in Plaisir, literally translated pleasure. How much pleasure there will be to be had, I'm not entirely sure. Anyway, that was a bit of a detour. It is Sunday night. Yesterday was Saturday. Let's try to
we've been on Paris Nice for one day and we've already lost our sense of time.
Completely lost our bearings. But we were also glued as much as we could be travelling yesterday to what happened in Tuscany and the Strade Bianche. Difficult, Richard, to find the superlatives, and difficult for everyone today, and it has been difficult over the last few years to find sufficient hyperbole superlatives for not just Tadej Pogacar, but you know, this generation that I saw them. Well, I saw people coining the term the Big Six, the Super Six. Today we've heard Big Four before, Big Five. I think the Super Six is, which is kind of what the Italians are going with at the moment, or the Big Six. Let me see if I can remember. It's Remco, it's Roglic, it's Van Aert, it's Van der Poel, it's Pogacar, and there's one missing.
Maybe that's another discussion.
I'll think of who it is in a second. Anyway, difficult to find superlatives. Richard, can you find any?
Well, I mean, yes, I could, because I read Alex Roos's piece in L'Equipe. I won't read it all out, but Alex Roos, to those who aren't familiar with him, L'Equipe's sort of chief correspondent for cycling these days, and very much keeping the literary tradition of French cycle reportage alive. Hyperbole, madness, daydreams, in this sun which finally broke through to illuminate the ultimate beauty of the Tuscan countryside. A lovely piece of prose to talk about what I think we might look back on, perhaps in different eyes to those that we're looking at it now, as one of Pogacar's sort of crowning achievements in his cycling career. I kind of wonder what it was like to be a reporter or even just a fan during the era of Merckx, where copy.
It was great because you just got to make half of it up. That was the greatest virtue.
And recycle the copy.
Yeah, I mean, we've said this before on the podcast. I mean, in all seriousness, a large part of the mythology of faster copy does come from the fact that a lot of it was reported on the radio. And so there was a far greater degree of mystique than there is to being able to see every kilometre of every race. I know that's a contentious point this year because suddenly we can't see every kilometre of every race with what's happened to GCN. However,
what I'm wondering is, at the time when Merckx was doing Merckxy things, did people realise that this was a really significant moment in his career or in the history of cycling? Was there an awareness that what was being watched was something that was going to have its place in 50 years' time? And I wonder, with what Pogacar did, you know, attacking that far out, riding away like that. I mean, very much Alex's viewpoint, and I think I would agree with him, is that this is a sort of ride that is going to put Pogacar up into that kind of pantheons of, like, it's a cliche, but sort of legends of the sport. It's not just people who win lots, but it's people who win with a certain style and a certain panache. And I think already you don't need a huge amount of hindsight to be able to see that in what we saw on Saturday.
Yeah, I think, well, the numbers already say it. 64 wins so far. He's only 25 years of age. Interestingly, there were a lot of comparisons with Merckx today. We'll probably talk more about Merckx in a minute. There was a comparison, in fact, with Merckx in Alex's piece in L'Equipe. I'll just read another bit. A masterpiece to put alongside the Slovenians in the Tour of Flanders last year, but also alongside some of the great moments in cycling history of riders alone against themselves on their path to greatness. We'll also never forget how, well, this is Alex referring to Pogacar's sort of, well, his arrival on the scene. We'll never forget how a learned observer of professional cycling reported back from the Tour de l'Avenir in 2018, the edition of Pogacar's breakthrough, that he'd seen Eddy Merckx. And well, yesterday we also saw Eddy Merckx. So I said, Pogacar, 64 wins up to this point. He's 25. How many wins do you think Merckx had at this age, at exactly this age, sort of 25 in 6 months. It's not a fair comparison, and you'll see why when I tell you the number.
Let me think. I just remembered that I'm speaking to somebody who's written the Merck's biography. I'm going to say Merck's had fewer.
He had 117.
117?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
They did race more in those days.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talked there about this awareness that what was happening was, well, certainly era-defining and maybe sport-defining or sport-redefining back in the day. I've done this a few times over the last 2 or 3 years, faced with these extraordinary performances by these extraordinary riders like Pogacar. I've gone back and read in my own book, for example, what the sort of the key years, I suppose, 68, 69, when this was dawning on everyone, dawning on a lot of riders. And this was sort of a key theme in my book as well, that the likes of Felice, Gimondi, even Poulidor, Pinjon, there were others, it dawning on them that their career was going to look quite different to what they'd hoped because this guy had emerged on the scene. But, you know, there definitely was, in Merckx's case as well, this sort of slow sense of a penny dropping. And I mean, Merckx's nickname is the Cannibal. That nickname was coined at the end of his first Tour de France, 1969, and it was quickly sort of embraced and taken on. And okay, it's only a nickname, but it became quite a sort of literal description of what was happening. Even then, you know, his probably most famous rides to Mohanx in 1969 when he went over the Tourmalet and won by, I forget how many minutes, was it 17 minutes? Or he won the Tour by 17 minutes, he won by 9 minutes. You read what was written after that and certainly you get the sense that everyone knew that the sport was being redefined before their eyes.
Yeah, I guess that there wasn't a Super 6 back in 69, was there? Were there any riders who could...
Well, I think, and again, this was a kind of a theme of my book, people thought there was, and they thought it comprised guys like Gianni Motta, Gimondi, and then Godefroot, De Vlaeminck, or De Vlaeminck came a little bit later. But people thought there was, and that was kind of obliterated by someone who was a plane above them. It's different about this era, and we're blessed because it is different. And, you know, I suppose this just brings on as well to another theme of yesterday's race. One thing that has been said and was sort of said on the TV commentary as well, Van der Poel wasn't there, Van Aert wasn't there, and maybe to a certain extent that explains, I don't know, how many of the 2 minutes, 44 seconds...
Yeah, I think that's definitely a point worth making, in that the fact and the details of that victory, the huge time gap, the vast distance alone was, I think, as much a factor of the chase or the lack of and the disorganisation behind and also the calibre of the riders. I mean, no disrespect.
It was kind of by design, though, wasn't it? He and UAE had obliterated the chase before the chase could happen,
yeah.
Really.
And to see... I mean, when he did attack on that sort of that dip on the Santa Maria section. I mean, you could see how strung out it was. It wasn't necessarily that the riders were having to follow Pogacar's kind of power. It was more that they were just unable to go that fast on the gravel as well. That was as much a part of his attack. Although, admittedly, I'm sure once he's got away, you know, that we know that he's capable of doing that in a kind of pure numbers or power to weight sense. I suppose I wonder what would have happened had there been slightly better caliber of opposition. Van der Poel in peak form that we've seen at Strade Bianche before. Has Vingegaard raced?
Ah, Vingegaard, number six.
Number six, the mystery six rider. Yeah.
The missing member of the super big, fantastic, marvellous
six. They'd make an amazing but also horrific boy band. With the frosted tips that Pogacar's debuting.
I almost pulled out, can you remember, you're too young, I think, to remember, there was an Italian rider called Fabio Sacchi who rode for Saeco. And for some reason, at some point in the sort of noughties or maybe late 90s, he went with like a tiger or a sort of leopard print hairdo, but featuring kind of frosted tips as well. But he wasn't a particularly distinguished rider. But yeah, generally, when people go for the sort of peroxide dye, it's not turned out particularly well in professional cycling, but this was an exception. Anyway, you were trying to make a serious point, I think.
Yeah, I suppose I would have liked to have seen Pogacar come head to head against some of those riders who we know are of his caliber, and see what happened, because I think, you know, he was able to dictate that race in a way that meant he just sort of withdrew himself and extricated himself from the peloton. Someone made the point that, you know, this was his first race back, but he only spent a few hours in the peloton and then he just disappeared off on what was essentially kind of a training ride again, although probably at a higher intensity than what he was doing in training. So yeah, I guess that was what was missing from a kind of a sporting perspective, but that doesn't really take anything away from what we saw.
No, and you mentioned the location of his decisive attack. It's not uncanny, because it was completely, but again by design, completely intentional, but it was almost to the blade of grass at the side of the road, almost to the sort of grain of gravel. You have grains of gravel, I don't know, exactly where he attacked 2 years ago. On that occasion, of course, there were 50 kilometers to go to the finish. Yesterday there were 81 kilometers to go to the finish. There was some talk before yesterday's race, well, there was a lot of talk about the route and the fact that 30 kilometers had been added. There was some grumbling about that, some skepticism. People didn't think it was a good idea. I would sort of suggest that what we saw yesterday vindicated the grumbles. There were certainly a lot of complaints afterwards about the lack of suspense. We'll come on to that in a minute, and the sort of nature of dominance, domination, whether we like it or we don't like it. But in terms of the spectacle itself, I didn't think the race did itself any favours by having those extra sort of 30 kilometres.
No, I guess you probably get into this debate, and it's probably been had, about their motives for doing that and whether that was erring towards wanting to be seen alongside the other five, or the five monuments.
That's another super six.
It's another big six. Could be.
Did you see the title that RCS, you know, just plucked this one out of the air? RCS put on their press release yesterday, Pogacar wins the sixth monument.
Oof. Well, that settled it then, hasn't it? I mean,
RCS says it, then it must be true.
It must be true. I don't think having the original course or shorter race would have actually had that much of an effect on the outcome, given what we saw. But I think this is true for a lot of races across the board, not just Strada Bianchi, but this debate came up when they were looking at putting new climbs into San Remo and sort of making it more of a climber's course. But I don't agree with the logic that making a race harder makes it better. I think often when you actually remove some of the sort of physical obstacles that you or physical aspects that you might classify as making it difficult, so climbs or whatever, that doesn't necessarily add to the spectacle or the entertainment. It just makes it more of a kind of fight to the death, really, and we're the strongest rider. I was listening recently to a podcast that Lionel did when he went to Flanders a few years ago, and he was speaking to a colleague of ours, Ed Pickering, and he came up with a way of summarizing the Tour of Flanders, which I thought really hit the nail on the head with respect to this issue, which is that to win Flanders, you have to be strong, but you don't have to be the strongest. At least certainly historically, that's been the case with that race. And I think that's what makes a good bike race, is that certainly a one-day race, is that you have a pool of 20 or so riders who could win, and you don't create the conditions for that if you make the course too hard.
Yes. Well, maybe that feeds into the discussion we'll maybe have in a second about, again, domination, whether it's palatable or unpalatable. Just on San Remo, San Remo is an intriguing one, and it's paradoxical in the sense that San Remo, in theory, should have got easier for the current peloton, because they've got better bikes, more aerodynamic, and training methods are better and so on and so forth. So in theory, you would think that we would have even bigger groups going to the finish in San Remo and bigger bunch sprints than was the case 20 years ago. The opposite has happened. It's become more of a climbers race than it's ever been, which is due to a series of factors which would probably merit an in-depth investigation at some point. Some of them are kind of easily explained and some of them not, but I don't know whether in any way that can be applied to Strade Bianche and what we saw yesterday.
I did read what Tom Pidcock was saying afterwards when he came forth, and he was talking about eating all day. I think if you compare cycling now compared to 20 years ago, the approach to a one-day race was ride very steady and then they would ride flat out for that final hour. Whereas now it's all in from the gun, and that's changing the nature. So a climb like the Poggio, the final climb of Milan San Remo, now I rode up it on a Brompton a few years ago, which was, you know, it's not a hard climb, but you come at it after 6 hours of racing, and it might as well be like a wall. And if you've been racing hard for that 6 hours all the way out of Milan, that's what makes it difficult. It's not necessarily the course, it's how the race is ridden.
And yesterday was certainly, it was a very hard start to the race, and it continued to be hard. And, you know, that was why the group was so strung out by the time they got to the Santa Maria, and Pogacar was able to sort of snap that elastic, wasn't it? Just another, a couple of sort of notable performances we should mention. The other two podium finishers, Maxim van Hielt and Tom Schuins, who's been one of the sort of stars of the early season. What classics racing we have had. Schuins actually was in a move earlier on in the day, and he also crashed quite badly, collided with his teammate Tim Quinn Simmons. So that adds another sort of layer of prestige on his performance yesterday.
He was one of the strongest riders, I think, in that group that almost stayed away in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. With there were three Visma Lisa bikes, weren't there, and Squinch and a couple of others. Pidcock was in there, I think, off the top of my head, and Squinch was the one attacking. You sort of look at their history in the race. This is no disrespect to Squinch, but you know, the caliber of classics riders that he was up against, you'd sort of expect him to just sit in the wheels, but he was the one making moves and attacking. It sort of made you take note. I think, we're here at Paris-Nice with Mads Pedersen, who's almost won the first stage, which we'll come into. But you know, you think if you're Lidl Trek going into the classics in the coming weeks, that's such a good card to have. Those two riders, they probably offer something a little different, I think.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, and they also have, you know, Jasper Stuyven kind of gets overlooked, but of course he's a former Milan San Remo winner. So yeah, they're very well equipped for the classics, indeed. Richard, just thinking about the way people processed and watched yesterday, again, coming to this issue of Pogacar's crushing domination of yesterday's race. Again, I think Alex Rus in L'Équipe summed it up really well. This equation between these sort of competing forces of suspense versus the sense that when you are seeing a really dominant performance, you're seeing something that will linger a long time in the memory and consequently has a different value. So he said, such a performance obliterates the best of the rest. Of course, it kills all suspense, but it replaces that with a sense of the epic and the sense that we're witnessing something unique. Now, again, in relation to Pogacar, we've talked about this before on the podcast. Also with regard to other sports as well, and we've thought about how individual athletes have dominated other sports, and what has that made people feel about particular eras and particular athletes. We've talked about Tiger Woods before on the podcast. I think about Michael Jordan, LeBron James. I was thinking about tennis, and I was thinking about women's tennis, and there you've had, over the course of several decades, you've had these periods of real sort of uncontested almost supremacy from one player, And then you've also had these sort of transitional phases, eras, where there've been a lot of different best players in the world, women's number ones. And I sort of tried to ask myself, really, what, as a, you know, I'm not a huge tennis fan, but what is preferable? You know, Serena Williams was world number one for 319 weeks. She was last world number one in May 2017. Since then, nine different players have been world number one. How many could the average casual sports fan name? And does that, by definition, mean that the Serena Williams years were superior, have a higher value than the last 9 years, when probably before every Grand Slam, people have been genuinely uncertain about who was going to win? And, you know, the same can be applied possibly to Pogacar. We might at the end of this summer be saying similar things about Vingegaard and the Tour de France.
Yeah, it's a difficult comparison to make, because you can have a dominant tennis player who wins lots of Grand Slams, but if you look at how the sport of tennis is set up, there are lots of moments of suspense or jeopardy where there are potential pitfalls for that champion.
If it's 6-1, 5-1, well, you sort of have a little,
but each game and each set sort of resets, if that makes sense. Whereas in cycling, there's that continuity that, you know, there is an element of jeopardy in that, you know, let's use Pogacar as an example. He could puncture, or the chase could organise behind, and the gap could start coming down. And you'd as an entertainment experience for a fan, you have that dynamic that keeps an element of this on you. On, you know, keeps you on the edge of your seat. I don't know. I think what Alex is alluding to there and talking about is this sense of the epic. And I think what is not unique to cycling, but which cycling has in spades, is this sense of kind of epic endeavor. And I kind of call the epic police on that, because I think it's really overused, that word, but it's part of why we get into the sport, because this sense of like one man or one woman like out there in the wide world, in these in these environments, going out and doing efforts which seem sort of illogical, yeah, to a normal person, yeah. Impossible,
yeah. And unwise. What Pogacar did yesterday, or was start when he went away. When I first turned on, I wasn't tuned in when the coverage started, and then I sort of brought up an internet page with 70 kilometers to go, and I saw that he was 40 seconds off the front with 70 kilometers to go, and my first thought was, well, that's stupid.
he very quickly changed the
another thing that can provide jeopardy is this pursuit of history. And you know, you take Tiger Woods, for example, then you would watch the average tournament, and the kind of jeopardy is, he can't do it again, can he? Oh, he has. Oh, he can't beat that record, can he? Oh, he has. So that creates his own sort of suspense, even if he's 15 shots ahead of the field. And the other thing is, I mean, I think we spoke about it last night at dinner, you can have two analogous performances. Remco Evenepoel has had rides like Pogacar produced yesterday, okay, maybe in smaller races or different races. He's done it in San Sebastian and on other occasions, and objectively they're quite similar. Whether you like it or you don't will often just depend on subjective personal sort of proclivities, preferences for one rider over another, and those can depend on so many things. It can depend on how a rider looks on a bike, how he sounds in interviews, what country he's from, so on and so on. Mm.
And Pogacar is universally popular, much more so than Jonas Vingegaard. And actually, I noticed it for the first time watching yesterday was just how good he looks on a bike. Not in a classical sense. Like, I remember watching Bradley Wiggins always look like he was kind of born to do it. I think maybe just his body shape, and I suppose the fact that he came through the track and developed that finesse and suppleness. But but Pogacar just looked sort of, it's very hard to put my finger on what it was. Maybe I'll kind of come up with a metaphor.
I mean, he looks very dynamic and aggressive on a bike, which I like. He looks like he's going fast. Wiggins, you mentioned Wiggins stylistically, from a purist point of view, yeah, maybe he was sort of conventionally stylish on a bike. I didn't particularly like watching him ride a bike because he looked too tall to me.
Too kind of gangly,
yeah, and slightly almost too sort of still and too perfect and too in line that you didn't really get any sense of effort and sense of speed. And I think you do get that with Pogacar.
You do, but he's not the kind of out and out brute force that you get with Van der Poel, for example.
No.
So there is that. But
Richard, final thing on Pogacar for now. One slight concern I've got after yesterday's performance. Well, we could say two things. One, obviously, there are murmurs. It would be disingenuous to say there weren't. It does raise eyebrows in certainly among the cycling public that's been watching for 20, 30 years. It would be irresponsible not to keep that in mind, where the sports come from, and we should always ask questions, and we should always wonder, and we should always, well, try to find out as much information as possible about what is happening in the sport. I think everyone knows what I mean. On Pogacar, of course, there is no reason to be more suspicious about him than any other rider, apart from the performances. And also, I should say that I don't really get any sense of misgivings from other riders when you speak to other riders. That's never really the sense I've had, and you did used to, certainly you would get that back in the day. So there's that. The other thing on a less grave sort of level, I worry with him that every year in the winter, observers of the sport are somehow able to create a narrative whereby he is still going to win the Tour de France and he's still the favourite to win the Tour de France. And, you know, a couple of years ago, it was, last year, for example, it was the wrist injury in Liège. And, okay, oh, he's not quite ready, so his preparation's not ideal. Vingegaard wins. Oh, but it was because of that. The previous year, I can't remember what it was, but there was something. It was the stage over the Grenon way bonked, which you can say, oh, well, that's an isolated incident. That won't happen again. He's still going to be the favourite next year. And I feel that it's going to happen again. And I can already hear it and feel it happening. People are talking themselves into Pogacar being the guy who should win the Tour de France.
Ah, but he raced the Giro.
Well, there
he's
you go.
Tired.
Well, there you go. And ignoring the evidence of Vingegaard being a better Tour de France rider, which is not to say that Pogacar won't beat him, but part of my heart kind of sinks because it's not that different from what people used to do about with Jan Ulrich, for example. There was, you know, as dominant as Lance Armstrong was, the controversial Lance Armstrong, for 7 years, and as overweight as Ulrich would get in the winter, this narrative persisted that Ulrich was going to do it next year because he was going to finally get it together. And it kind of did him a disservice, with all the sort of caveats and asterisks that apply in cases like this, but it kind of did him a disservice. And I sort of feel the same about Pogacar.
I don't think Pogacar has the sort of inherent flaws is not the right word, but foibles perhaps, or, you know, with Jan Ulrich, it was very much, you know, the public understood that he had his struggles in the winter that kind of got in the way of his talent. But I think often in those instances that you've listed with Pogacar, it's more sort of bad luck, or it's not quite as systemic, or they're more racing incidents, perhaps, you know, an unfortunate crash where he broke his wrist.
So you're saying you agree? You're saying he's going to win.
Yeah, but he won't, because he's going to be tired from the Giro.
Next year, when there are finally no excuses, but there will be an excuse. There's always going to be an excuse. There's always going to be a reason, and I, you know, obviously he's an entertainer and he's a popular rider, and there's a large component, or there's a large part of people, of fans, who just are just desperate for it to happen again.
Yeah, but there wasn't an excuse in 2020, was there, when he won his first tour?
Yeah. But there was no Jonas Vingegaard.
Well, do you think, Daniel, that he is capable of winning the Giro and the Tour?
No. Unlikely. If Vingegaard is fit and at his best at the start of the Tour de France, just sort of final thing, I suppose, to say as well, another slight bugbear, this idea that, yesterday I heard our distinguished colleague, and he is a distinguished colleague because I really like his analysis of the sport, but yesterday Adam Blythe at one moment in the commentary, Stradale Bianche, or I think after the race, he talked about how, oh, we're so spoiled because this year we've got the big four, Remco, Roglic, Vingegaard and Pogacar, and this never happens, or it hasn't happened for so long, where we've got these four incredible riders and they're all going to be at the Tour de France, and it's going to be incredible. Unfortunately, most years we have a scenario like this in February or March. We create these narratives in our head that, oh, so and so, okay, he finished 8 minutes down last year, but oh no, but he fell on that stage, and this year if he doesn't crash then he's going to be a contender for the Tour. And you know, if you go back to pretty much any year over the past 20 years, in February, in January, if you pick up any sort of old issue of cycle sport or pro cycling, all they do is build the narrative that there are going to be three or four or five riders who are potential Tour de France winners, and it's never the case. We will, unfortunately, and I really don't want to tempt fate, and I wish for all of them that they get there on good form, but Roglic, Remco, Vingegaard, and who's the other one? Or was that four? Was that four already? Pogacar.
They really need to sort out this lineup. Who's on drums and who's on bass?
Or Pogacar. Unfortunately, one of them will not be at their best, or they will probably not be at the start, and another one of them will lose time on day two or day three, and it happens every year, and we never get this perfect sort of alignment of the planets where we have this incredible spectacle of the meeting of era-defining riders at the Tour de France.
And I know that, but I want to suspend that, and I want to go into the talk happy in my ignorance.
I'll be telling you I told you so.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views and interviews from the world of professional cycling.
So David, I'm going to ask you to turn, well, you're already a sort of pundit, but I'm going to ask you just as an observer, as a fan as well to a certain extent, how do you think their 2024 seasons are going to go from here? A little bit of a sort of educated guess, and maybe a hope for both of them.
I'm gonna say a hope, not a guess or to anything to know exactly. But let's really hope that Tadej wins that Giro, and that in the Tour de France, all of the four big ones are there in the top shape, and then we'll see. You know, last year somebody asked me after the stage at the Tour, Puy de Dôme stage, and asked, wow, you Slovenians are gonna win all three Grand Tours this year. Does it, sorry, I know it's Jumbo, but you know, I cheer for Slovenians, so I hope so. But it turned out as it turned out. So I'm hoping it would be a different story this year, and I really hope that one of those two wins also the Tour de France. But you know, it's difficult.
Hugo Kordowitz, a press room legend. In his last year as a journalist, I think. Unfortunately, we'll miss him.
Auxerre is for me Giroud, the biggest.
For me as well. Yeah. I said the same thing this morning, Hugo. I went for my run alongside the stadium.
Yeah, but it was still 0-0.
I didn't know the name of the stadium, though. Did you? The Stade Nautique.
Where?
Great name for a stadium, the Nautic Stadium, alongside the river. Yeah. Giroud, I was trying to think, Hugo, who's the... Well, I know who it is. The cycling equivalent of Giroud has to be Hilaire van der Schuren. No, but he's retired this year, the former Intermarché boss.
Yeah, but Walter Plankard is still on the road. He has the same age.
Which is?
Walter Plankard is the sports director of Flanders Baloise, and he won the Tour of Flanders, he won Amstel Gold Race, and many other races, but he's still sports director. I don't know, I think he has 70 years.
Great character as well. Hugo, since we've got you here, Remco at Paris-Nice, at the start of the week he said, oh, stage win, maybe finish on the podium. We didn't really believe him. We think he wants more than that. What do you think about him this week?
I think he wants more, but he doesn't want to pronounce it so clear, because you have a certain Roglic here. Roglic, he won and showed how you have to win Paris-Nice, but you saw also the last day that he needed the help of Wout van Aert, who was a real sherpa for him the last day, otherwise he didn't won. And there was also an addition when Maximilian Schachmann won the second time. Primoz Roglic was by far the best, had three stage wins, but he crashed two times and he lost Paris-Nice in Livens against Maximilian Schachmann.
That last stage, Hugo, that day, it was a rescheduled last stage, wasn't it? I think we're going to have a stage like that on Saturday because of the snow in Oran.
Yeah, because I spoke to Le Marchand, the man who designed Paris-Nice, and he said, okay, it's snow over there, but we always have alternative roads over there. So, you know, in this part of the mountains of after Nice, it's always tricky, really tricky.
Hugo, officially this could be your last Paris-Nice, but I don't believe it. I think you'll be back next year. We hope you're back next year. Well, Richard, that was a couple of vignettes, a couple of sort of postcards from Paris-Nice from our colleagues in the international media. The legend Hugo Korwitz from Het Nieuwsblad, and David Chermil was the first voice we heard. I thought that was a nice bridge from David of Slovenian national television, talking about his hopes for the season, and, well, it was a nice bridge from our previous conversation in the last part about Tadej Pogacar to Primoz Roglic, who, of course, is going to be one of the protagonists, of course, in the second half of this. Paris-Nice has been a protagonist in Paris-Nice in the past, of course. Richard, we have on this infamous space-time continuum of this episode, we are now, what day is it? Tuesday?
Day three,
Tuesday. We'll Google it later.
Afternoon.
And where are we?
We're in Auxerre. Quite a nice surprise. Small town, but lots of medieval remnants. I was reading I think it was a mayor around the turn of the 19th century decided not to allow a train station to be built in Auxerre, which crippled it economically, but seems to have perhaps preserved it architecturally. And it has that sort of Dukes of Burgundy medieval half-timbered feel, I think.
Yeah, it's quite a fetching city. I don't remember ever having come here on the Tour de France. I'm sure I have, but it's a bit of a...
The Tour doesn't come here, does it? I remember I wrote a piece a few years ago about the places where the Tour doesn't come, and these départements, like in the middle of France, that sort of empty diagonal that runs like southwest to northeast, where there aren't an awful lot of people, there aren't an awful lot of cities, and the Tour just avoids it pretty regularly, although this year being quite an exception because we will have a couple of stages in Troyes, Orléans, and then down to like the middle of France. So talking of Primoz Roglic, not long ago just seen him get lost in these sort of medieval streets after doing the TTT recon, which is kind of like part and parcel of pro cycling, isn't it? These sort of like alien figures in, well, maybe to come onto the helmet, but peculiar kits kind of zooming around town and attracting the looks of, I mean, there's a decent crowd out.
Smattering of, unfortunately, a very aging, as discussed many times on the Cycling Podcast, a very aging public attends bike races in France, particularly at this time of year. Paris-Nice, of course, it's not school holidays. Primoz Roglic's getting sort of lost and whimsically rolling around a medieval Burgundian town. Seems somehow on brand for Primoz Roglic.
And kind of on brand for Paris-Nice as well. It's sort of, there's just, there isn't that stress, is there? There isn't that intensity of energy of like attraction or interest. Although that said, I did, I mean, I've not been to this race before, so I don't have a direct comparison to in the past, but compared to the Tour, I mean, they're taking it pretty seriously. I was expecting things to maybe be a little bit more late.
You think that it was like a fairground? No, well, yeah. A fairground race, as we call them, a kermesse. No, this is it. I mean, the race builds itself as a mini Tour de France with a great field. Of course, the big, well, last part was almost dedicated to the big six, who exactly they are. The big four, as far as the Tour are concerned, only two of them are here, aren't they? Remco and Roglic. And just on the stress levels or lack of stress levels, I think it has been I wouldn't say stressful week, but it's been a challenging week for Bora Hansgrohe, because this is, well, for a lot of them and a lot of their staff, this is the first experience of having a potential Tour de France winner. They genuinely think that he's a potential Tour de France winner. And that comes with a lot of other things, doesn't it? A lot of stress behind the scenes, different members of staff, more staff. And I think Primoz Roglic, the message that I've been getting from individuals within that organisation is that, yes, he's brought a lot of good things already. I was chatting to Mateo Sobrero yesterday about this, and he's very impressed with everything that Roglic has brought. But he brings a level of expectation and, and a lot of the sort of good things that we've talked about at Jumbo-Visma, now Visma-Lisa bike, that they're sort of trying to transpose onto Bora Hansgrohe.
And there's also things that you can't directly transpose as well. I mean, how long, what are we... start of March, so Primoz has been involved with that team, let's say, since November in the first training camp round then, so it's only 4 months and what you can't directly transpose as easily as equipment or technical know-how is the sort of interpersonal relationships. I was chatting with Pachi Villa at Bora as well about training really and how and why it is that riders are coming out flying after their winter breaks, but he sort of stressed the importance of those interpersonal ways of managing individuals. And as much as, you know, teams and riders have got training pretty dialed now across the board, and sometimes it can come down to just knowing the individual, what works well for them, how you manage them, how you just sort of deal with them on a more sort of person-to-person basis, which I think is sort of overlooked a little bit when you think about cycling transfers. They're not robots. As much as they want to sort of hide behind equipment and kit and so on, like that, it's a big part of it.
Yeah, and Roglic hasn't brought a massive entourage with him. Of course, he's brought his coach with him, but he didn't come, you know, with Jan Tratnik in his suitcase. And maybe he would very much have liked a Jan Tratnik in his suitcase. But a lot of new relationships that Roglic will have to build and forge and sort of consolidate over the next few months. Just on Roglic yesterday, I had a chat with him yesterday morning, and looking very gaunt, very thin. Looking very fit. I believe he's pretty fit, as most professional cyclists usually are, but I think they're pretty happy with how the preparation, the physical preparation has gone. His sort of counterpart, or his main adversary, we think, on this Paris-Nice, Remco Evenepoel. I was chatting to his coach this morning, Kern Pelgrim, and they too are very satisfied with the way Remco's winter's gone. Of course, he took more time off the bike this year, and the feedback from that so far has been very positive. No altitude for him yet, but he's going to do, I think, 3 altitude camps before the Tour de France, one in Sierra Nevada in Spain, one in the Alps, and I forget where the third one is, maybe the Teide. Richard, should we have another postcard from Paris-Nice? Another impression of sort of a watercolour painting of Paris-Nice from a rider. You spoke to the Bahrain Victorious rider, Jack Haig, a couple of days ago. Jack Haig, who fortunately has been spared the fate suffered by his teammate Peyo Bilbao yesterday. If anyone's watching the team time trial today, well, you probably won't see, because it will be obscured by his helmet. He's got a rather prominent cut on his brow, and that was as a result of having, well, needed to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night 2 nights ago, and sort of staggered towards the bathroom in his own, probably campanile or something like that, and misjudged the height of the door frame, and suffered a nasty crash, nasty collision with the door frame. The doctor was called, and he told me yesterday he didn't have stitches. I had heard that he did need stitches, but quite a nasty cut. Anyway, no such adversity for Jack Haig so far in this Paris-Nice, but it's a race that's full of adversity for everyone really who rides, as Jack told you, I think, a couple of days ago.
Well, Paris-Nice.
Yeah.
Does this feel like the season has really begun now?
Yeah.
8 degrees, grey.
Yeah, I've started maybe the World Tour calendar part of my season in Paris-Nice quite often, and I've always done relatively well here, but it's never really a race that I particularly enjoy, especially the first couple of days. I guess I progressively enjoy the race better as we get closer to Nice.
For someone who's not used it before, how would you describe?
It's a mixture of like the opening weekend and then one of the preparation races like Ruta del Sol or Vuelta Algarve. It's a mixture of those two, because in opening weekend you just have the big classic guys. In like Ruta del Sol or Algarve you have just normally the climbing guys, and then here you get the combination of both, and it can be quite a rude shock if you've come from one of those non-World Tour races and you're used to moving through the peloton quite easily and not stressing too much, and you come here and you have all the big classic guys and it's all a little bit harder.
And then they throw in a team time trial on stage three as well.
Yeah, we had this last year as well. We had the team's time trial. I'm not sure I'm such a fan of it. I would maybe prefer to have an individual time trial, to be honest. But maybe it's more interesting for the spectators. I don't know. What would you prefer, actually?
It's a good question. I think, given that it's a preparation race for a lot of the riders that we're going to see in the Tour de France, it would make more sense to see an individual time trial, which is what we're going to see in the Tour.
Yeah, I also agree. Like, if there's a team's time trial on the Tour, maybe do a team's time trial here. But if there's an individual time trial on the Tour, maybe do an individual time trial here. And always, like, just the team's time trial, there's just so much stress around team's time trials.
Well, how much are you... I mean, when it was back in the Worlds, I suppose you were training for it a reasonable amount, maybe. But these days, perhaps not so much.
And again, it comes back to that thing where, because it's not the Tour de France, there's not as much pressure or much emphasis on it, because I'm not sure what other races have team's time trials this year. I don't think...
Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Giro doesn't?
No.
Tour doesn't? Maybe Vuelta?
Maybe. I have to double check that.
But yeah, there's not as much emphasis. Like, if there is one in the Tour de France, then there's more emphasis put on it. And, for example, last year we did quite a bit of training in the December and January training camps to practice the team's time trial. I missed the January training camp this year because I was in Australia, so I missed that part of the training. But yeah, there is some emphasis put on it, but not maybe as much because there isn't in the Tour de France.
Yeah. People have been talking about Remco being here and the fact he's not raced in France much before. And so that's part of his program, is coming here and getting a flavour of racing on French roads. How would you describe those? What is the sort of French flavour to being on an ASO race, but also specifically racing on French roads?
I think there's quite a bit more road furniture on the French roads, to be honest. Like, if I was to pick somewhere, I prefer racing in Spain. Generally, the roads are a little bit bigger. There's not as much road furniture on the roads, whereas in France, it's much maybe smaller, twistier roads with a lot more road furniture, and just is a bit of a different feeling around it, and there's maybe just a little bit more of just general overall stress to the day, because there's always a dangerous point coming up, or there's always like the crest of a little climb where there's maybe crosswinds, or there's always like something, whereas maybe in Spain you can relax a little bit more.
Yeah. And are the sports directors in your ear?
Yeah, of course.
More often?
Yeah, just of course. There's just more to say, so they're in the ear a bit more.
Yeah. And what do you expect from this race? You know, the field that's here and the caliber of opposition you'll be coming against. What are your kind of predictions for what's going to happen?
Me personally, or as like an overall race?
Both.
As an overall race, I think you'll probably see it battled out by the two favourites, Primoz and Remco. Then I kind of hope, from a spectator's point of view, you'll start to see maybe that third to fifth place quite hotly contested, and maybe getting a glimpse into who's on form this season. And then for me personally, we come here with quite a strong team in Bahrain with Peo and Santi, and they will be the GC guys here, so just trying to sort of support them. And both of them are showing they're in good form. Like, Peo just came from third in UAE Tour, and then Santi had a really good result in Vuelta Valencia. He missed out on a bit of the opportunity in Andalusia, but I'm sure he'll show good form here and is always strong.
Well, Richard, Jack there with his thoughts on this team time trial format, Paris-Nice in general. Paris-Nice is a race where every year when I come here, the sort of feedback I get is that most riders really find this to be a rewarding experience as far as condition is concerned, and they certainly think that it can sort of dial their form up a couple of notches, but it can be a bruising experience as well.
Yeah, but also I think we saw that a little bit yesterday when the start of the stage was rolling along at sort of not much more than 30k an hour, I think. And yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. There's snow, right, on some of those final stages, which I guess we'll probably know a bit more about in the coming days as to whether that's going to affect the race. But yeah, you got the sense from the riders and from the peloton that like it's going to get a lot harder. It's not going to be an easy ride from here. And it was sunny. It was quite fairly calm. It was a flat sprint stage, and they were taking a rare opportunity to take it easy. So,
any other observations, thoughts, things you've noticed over the past 3 or 4 days? Sporting or sportive or extra sportive? We had a nice dinner last night. Not often too many culinary highlights in the first few days of Paris-Nice, but last night we had a very nice meal in Auxerre.
I like this way of travelling on bike races because you go to places that you would never normally go to. They're not on a tourist trail. I wouldn't recommend Auxerre for your next holiday, but it's pretty nice, isn't it? And it's nice to bump into these sort of places that you stumble across. I've been asking around about the young Kiwi on FDG actually to this morning.
Thomas Beauclerc just brushing his teeth out of the boot of his car just a few 50 metres away. Anyway, sorry, carry on. Lawrence Pithy,
who he's in the yellow jersey today. Quite how long he keeps hold of that, I don't think anyone in FDG has sort of delusions there that they're going to hold on to that after the team time trial today. But one of a number of Anglophone or Anglo-Saxon riders, young ones, who are now part of Groupama FDG. And
it's a sore subject, this is.
Well, yeah, I think it sort of touches a nerve of yours, doesn't it, Daniel, about the purity of... have you read Les Mains Sales by Jean-Paul Sartre? You know, it's sort of a discussion about purism versus pragmatism and about these politicians in a sort of fictional country. And I think that for anyone who's read it, the FDG is siding with Herderer, the pragmatist, because for a long time the FDG was this bastion of francophonie, right? It was French riders, French team, Marc Madiot singing the Marseillaise.
Yeah, famous incident in GP Cholet a few years ago, where the traditional pre-race direct sportifs meeting, the chief commissaire started to speak in English, and Marc Madiot walked out, stormed out in protest.
Well, it's a good job he's not here, because apparently as we've mentioned a couple of times, the briefings now are taking place in English. Sacré bleu. I spoke with Benoît Vaugrenard, who is a former rider and sports director with FDG, about these young riders. Pithy in particular, they were really impressed with him. He's a junior world champion on the track, and you can see a lot of that track craft in the way he's racing. He's got a couple of podiums here which put him in the yellow jersey. They're not putting too much expectation on his shoulders in terms of Milan San Remo, his next race, and the Belgian Classics. He'll probably race with Stefan Kung as well as a joint leader, but they've got high hopes. And I was asking about why they were picking up these young riders and why there weren't as many or why they were siding and going for English speaking like New Zealand riders. They've got a couple of Brits and they have done from their development team. And Benoît was saying that actually in France it's a lot more common for young riders to stay in education until they're 18, which it's not like all of the young Brits are high school dropouts, but he sort of hinted that was, you know, just delaying the development of young French riders by a year or two. And so actually when they're picking up these youngsters, that these young guys from New Zealand, from the UK, Australia, they really stand out. So it's kind of, it feels a bit like if you can't beat them, join them on FDG, doesn't it?
Yeah, they've been slow adopters of this sort of method now of
blooding young riders very early. The French teams have sort of stuck to the dogma until very recently, until the last sort of 2 years, they've stuck to the dogma according to which a rider is only really ready at 22 or 23 and should only be doing the biggest races, i.e. the Tour de France, when they're sort of 24 or 25. Pithy has been really impressive. I haven't got a pithy final line to end this podcast, Richard, but I will tell you that yesterday I sent a message to Thibaut Pinot's brother, Julien Pinot, who is now, well, he's sort of the head of all things performance at Groupama. And I said it was disgusting and heresy that they were now doing their briefings in English. He, of course, laughed, but blamed it on Brexit, because he said that English speaking, well, English riders in particular now are very good value because of Brexit. I don't think he was being serious. However, it has to stop. We hope it does stop. No more English in briefings at Groupama FDJ.
I did ask if I could interview Benoit in English, but he sort of sheepishly said, it's not very good. So they are clinging on to a few.
Well, Richard, this has been an unusual episode, but hopefully the listeners have enjoyed it and I've enjoyed your company at Paris-Nice. And well, I'll be back next week from Italy, I think, and with an as yet to be confirmed guest.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.